considering the move an act of international piracy.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela denounces and repudiates energetically what constitutes a blatant theft and an act of international piracy, announced publicly by the President of the United States, who confesses the assault of an oil ship in the Caribbean. What they want is to steal our oil, to steal it. To steal our gold, they want to steal our gas, they want to steal our water because they don't want to pay. And why don't they pay for it? Because they are thieves, they are accustomed to that. So that's why I say that we are ready to carry on and take on everything, prolonged and active resistance.
Cabello said the real reasons behind the prolonged aggression against Caracas have now been exposed. He said fighting drug trafficking is only a justification. Cabello said the reason has always been about Venezuela's natural wealth, its oil, its energy, and resources that belong solely to the Venezuelan people. He added that Caracas will appeal this seizure to all available international bodies. The condemnation follows a statement by U.S. President Donald Trump announcing the seizure of an oil tanker off Venezuela's coast.
As you probably know, we've just seized a tanker on the coast of Venezuela, large tanker, very large, largest one ever seized, actually. And other things are happening, so you'll be seeing that later, and you'll be talking about that later with some other people.
Trump said U.S. military forces conducted a large-scale operation to seize the oil tanker without offering any more details. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi posted a video of the seizure on social media claiming that the vessel had been involved in an illicit oil shipping network supporting foreign terrorist organizations. She also alleged the tanker was used to transport sanctioned oil from Venezuela and Iran. Reacting to the seizure, Iran's embassy in Caracas has expressed solidarity with Venezuela and condemned U.S. takeover of the vessel as an act of piracy. The Iranian embassy called it a violation of Venezuela's national sovereignty and a blatant breach of international laws. Trump recently threatened Venezuela with an imminent land invasion, accusing the country of aiding the flow of drugs and migrants into the United States, which Caracas denies. Well, to look deeper into the situation, we're now joined by author and commentator John Stepling, who's with us from Andorra, Norway. We also have editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, joining us from Saidia, Morocco. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Stepling. Mr. Stepling, please just give us your perspective on how events have transpired with regards to Venezuela. First, the targeting of ships off the coast of Venezuela, and now it seems to have entered into a new phase with the seizure of this oil tanker.
The U.S. can't invade Venezuela. They're not capable of an actual land invasion, some kind of amphibious invasion with boots on the ground. They can't do it. The American public has no appetite for the deaths of American military personnel either. So they're going to avoid that at all costs. The original justification for blowing up these fishing boats in the Caribbean was that they were transporting fentanyl. The boats couldn't even reach the United States. They don't have the range for that. The cartel that they accuse Maduro of being the head of doesn't exist. It's a mythical cartel. So this was all. They just keep inventing new stories, the U.S. government, that is. Just keep inventing new justifications. And they don't even try very hard. Now they seize an oil tanker. This is, you know, it looks very good, but there's 300 some other tankers out there delivering oil. This is meaningless. It's a little tiny drop in the bucket. It has some symbolic resonance, I guess. But the U.S. is not going to invade. They may bomb a few places, but they're terrified that Venezuela will shoot back. So this is a country that's like a rabid dog that has been cornered. And it's very dangerous in one sense because it's unpredictable. Trump is trying to find things to do that will distract from Ukraine, Gaza, and Jeffrey Epstein, and not necessarily in that order. So, this is piracy. Is it illegal? Of course it is. Blowing up the fishing boats was illegal, too. But the U.S. doesn't care. They're flailing about, as I say, and they're like a cornered dog that is snarling and yapping, but isn't going to ultimately do much damage, I don't think.
Kevin Barrett, I'd like you to weigh in on the situation as well. Venezuelan officials have said that whatever the U.S. is doing, it's just along the lines of justification, specifically alluding to the attacks on the fishing boats. Venezuelans, high-ranking officials say that it's always been about Venezuela's natural wealth, its oil, its energy, and its resources. How would you explain what the U.S. Is doing with regards to Venezuela, specifically this massive military buildup in the Caribbean?
Well, I recently wrote an article. It's posted at the UNZ Review, UNZ.com, pointing out that we're living through a kind of a deja vu flashback to George W. Bush's buildup to war with Iraq, in that in both cases we have preposterously false justifications for these attacks on oil-rich nations. In the case of Bush Jr., they made up stories of Iraq having weapons of mass destruction that clearly didn't exist. And Trump's people are making up even more ridiculous stories about a different kind of chemical weapon, fentanyl. But it's widely known and admitted by everyone, including the U.S. government, that virtually all fentanyl consumed in the United States is manufactured in Mexico. Mexico, of course, is directly south of the United States. Venezuela is down in South America and has nothing to do with fentanyl. The fishing boats that Trump has been blowing up and murdering people, and Hegseth has been ordering to double tap and kill survivors, these are extremely grotesque war crimes. These fishing boats have nothing to do with any fentanyl. So that whole excuse is preposterous, just like the Iraq war excuses were. And Trump is, of course, beating his chest like a baboon, like Bush did in 2003, and defaming the leader of the sovereign oil-rich nation that he wants to attack. Back then, Bush was calling Saddam Hussein an evil dictator, and that's the sort of rhetoric that we're now hearing from Trump about Maduro. But what is this really all about? Well, it is largely about the fact that it's an oil-rich country, and the United States right now is smarting under the sting of being slapped in Ukraine, being unable to leverage any power with China, and it's in a position to lose a war with China over Taiwan. So what else can they do? Well, they can go try to attack a smaller country in the American hemisphere. But again, I agree with the other guest. I don't think that's going to work. But I think the hidden factor here that isn't being mentioned in the mainstream media is that it's really not about oil in the sense that the United States can buy Venezuelan oil. Maduro, as he just said, will happily sell the United States Venezuelan oil at a perfectly reasonable price. Why won't the United States take yes for an offer? Just, it was the same situation with Saddam Hussein in 2003. The reason is that the United States is owned by Jewish Zionist gangsters who completely dominate the media and the financial sector. And those Jewish Zionist gangsters are not even loyal to the United States of America or its empire. They are loyal to the genocidal entity squatting in Palestine. And that's why Saddam Hussein was taken out, not because he had oil that he wouldn't sell. He wanted to sell his oil to the United States. They took him out because he was building up a military that had as its ultimate intention the liberation of Palestine. And in Venezuela, we have a government there that is very much allied with the resistance axis and has an independent foreign policy and opposes the genocide of Palestine. And the Jewish Zionist gangsters that have taken over the United States, murdered the Kennedys, blew up the World Trade Center on 9/11, and have destroyed my country, so I don't even want to live there anymore. Those horrific monsters are behind these crimes against Venezuela.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for this segment of the show. author and commentator John Stepling joining us from Andorra, Norway, and also thanks to editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, speaking to us from Saidia, Morocco. Moving on, Colombians have held a rally in the capital, Bogota, over U.S. threats against Venezuela and attacks on vessels in the Caribbean.
I believe that Washington's aggression will not stop, which means that tensions will continue. We, as Colombians, must defend our territory, call for national unity, support our government and the Venezuelan government, and seek joint action not only to defend peace, but also to defend our territory from aggression and from the systematic murder that Washington has begun against fishermen in the region.
We reject the U.S. threats of armed invasion of Venezuela and Colombia. These acts of war, the way Trump is acting extrajudicially, killing people in the Caribbean and the Pacific, violates human rights.
The rally was held outside the U.S. Embassy in Colombia's capital. Protesters slammed U.S. attacks, calling them extrajudicial killings. They called on the U.N. to take action and stop U.S. violations. Protesters warned that Washington's actions may escalate tensions and turn into an all-out war. They also voiced support for the Venezuelan government. Demonstrators denounced the U.S. interference in Latin America, urging unity and peace in the face of mounting pressure. As the globe marks the International Human Rights Day, many may wonder if U.S. President Donald Trump is familiar with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as he continues to ramp up war threats against the Venezuelan people. Rami Mazari reports from Washington, D.C.
In 1948, the only human rights agreement embraced by all nations was signed, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It affirms that every person is born with equal dignity and rights, and its basis was the Code of the French Revolution, also called the Napoleonic Code. Many ideas added were inspired by the decline of monarchism and the rise of socialism after World War I, and the failures of fascism and the shortcomings of liberalism shown by World War II. In most of the world, the United States isn't usually associated with defending human rights, but with violence and transgression. And protesters gathered to denounce President Donald Trump's menacing buildup for a possible war on Venezuela.
It's a very authoritarian kind of way of operating, and the world sees right through it, it seems like. But we just have so much military and financial power that there's a lot of, it's not much that our allies really are caring to do about it either.
Decades of sanctions aimed at destabilizing socialist-inspired Venezuela into right-wing civil war haven't worked, so the U.S. has assembled its largest Caribbean armada since 1962, with airstrikes possible at any moment.
Maduro, who's lost citizens to our terrorist attacks on Venezuela, has to react sometime, because what he's showing is his weakness and he's not showing his sovereignty. When a country gets attacked like this, they have to do something, like Iran had to react to Israel and the United States doing something.
Polls show that almost 70% of the American public is opposed to Trump taking military action in Venezuela. A poll released in June, on the day of Washington's illegal strikes on Iran's nuclear energy program, showed that 85% of the United States didn't want to be at war with Iran. That indicates that the figure of 70% would likely rise should Trump start attacks on Venezuela's land.
In 1993, the first UN Human Rights Conference since the end of the Cold War was held in Vienna. The resulting declaration emphasized the universal rights to sovereignty and non-interference. It was not signed by the United States. Rami Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
The Israeli army continues to strike various areas of the Gaza Strip, violating the ceasefire agreement as the humanitarian crisis deepens for Palestinians in the territory. The regime's artillery targeted northeast of Al-Buraij camp in central Gaza. Further attacks were also reported in eastern Gaza City, with shelling behind the yellow line. Israeli strikes also hit the eastern parts of Al-Zaytun neighborhood. Meanwhile, Storm Byron has hit the occupied territories, causing heavy rainfall and flooding across the Gaza Strip. UNRWA says streets in Gaza are flooded and tents are soaked, making dire living conditions even worse for the enclave's forcibly displaced population. An 8-month-old infant tragically died in Khan Yunis due to the severe cold. UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese, says Palestinians have been left to freeze and starve in Gaza. The Israeli military has refused to allow the entry of many tents and mobile homes to Gaza despite the harsh weather conditions. But the U.S. House of Representatives has advanced a military spending bill for the next fiscal year that includes provisions for supporting Israel and Ukraine. Both Democrats and Republicans voted overwhelmingly to approve the measure. The bill prioritizes U.S.-Israeli military cooperation. It also authorizes $500 million in fiscal year 2026 for U.S.-Israeli missile cooperation. This includes funds for Israeli procurement of Iron Dome, David Sling, and Arrow, and for bilateral research. It also authorizes more aid to Ukraine. The bill now heads to the Senate for approval before being signed by President Donald Trump. And renewed clashes between Thailand and Cambodia have entered a fourth day, with each side accusing the other of reigniting the conflict. Cambodia's defense ministry said Thai forces launched multiple attacks on border regions in the early hours of the morning, deploying tanks and artillery to strike targets. It said Thailand violated humanitarian law by firing on civilians, calling on Bangkok to stop hostile activities, withdraw troops, and avoid further aggression. By Wednesday, the death toll on the Cambodian side stood at 10 civilians, with 60 others injured. Meanwhile, Thailand said 8 of its soldiers have lost their lives since fighting resumed. More than 500,000 civilians from both countries have fled border areas due to the violence. The conflict, now spreading across 5 provinces, marks the most serious escalation since a July ceasefire that ended 5 days of fighting. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Smile. I know it's been a while since I felt anything. first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Assalamu alaikum jamian wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then send our congratulatory messages to our 12th and living Imam al-Hujjah, Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, and to each and every one of you as we gather on this beautiful night to celebrate the birth anniversary of Our Lady of Light, the daughter of our beloved Prophet, Fatima al-Zahra, alayhim afdalu salatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. We pray to Allah Azza wa Jal that He bless us with a higher ma'rifah and knowledge of the Lady of Light in our lives, and that we receive her shafa'at in the hereafter. Before I begin, you know, it's nice to see that, alhamdulillah, our community is growing in different ways. And so now you see Islamic schools and the importance of Islamic schools being brought to the front of our reminders and of reality. And I hope, inshallah, we support such initiatives, inshallah, because this is how our future generations will prosper with true faith, inshallah. The title of Siddiqa is very important. It's a title that we are told is given to her by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Our sixth Imam As-Sadiq, alayhi afdalu salatu wassalam. Ma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Is reported to have said, li Fatimata alayha salam tis'atu asma indallah. That Fatima alayha salam has 9 names that have been given to her by Allah, that Allah recognizes her with these 9 names. What are they? Fatima, was-Siddiqa, wal-Mubaraka, the one who is blessed, wa-Tahira, the one who is clean or pure, Zakiya, there's an inner purity, wa-Radiya, and Mardiya, the one who is content, and the one whom God is content with, wal-Muhaddatha, the one who is spoken to by angels, was Zahra, yeah, the one who is illuminated. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So one of the titles that she's been given is the title of Siddiqa. Yeah? And the title of Siddiqa, the one who is, you know, it's described in English as the one who is voracious. Right? Voracious really means the one who is internally and externally truthful, like completely truthful. You will never find hints of falsehood within that person. You will never find any traces of that which is inconsistent from the truth within that person. That's a person who attains the status of being what's known as a Siddiq or a Siddiqa. And this is a title that has a lot of profound meaning associated to it, right? Again, we find a hadith that's reported by our sixth Imam, alayhi salam, where he was asked by another person by the name of Abi Abdullah, and he says to him, Man ghasala Fatima? That who gave ghusl to the body of Fatima? To which he replied back, he said, Daka Amir al-Mu'mineen. He said, Amir al-Mu'mineen gave ghusl to Fatima. And he was caught off guard, yeah, because we generally don't have men giving ghusl to women, right? And then Imam alayhi salam says to him, La tadiqanna, do not be surprised at this. He says, do not be shocked at this. For innaha siddiqa, wa lam yakun yaghsiluha illa siddiqun. SubhanAllah. Yeah? He says, she was a siddiqa, and none can give ghusl to a siddiqa except for a siddiq. Yeah? Ya Ali. And this is what we understand from this hadith, right? That to be a Siddiq or a Siddiqa is in a status of its own, right? And it is a status that, of course, we can strive towards. But when a person reaches that status, only those who have reached a similar status can understand that person. Only one who has reached a similar status, not that status, because there are statuses amongst the statuses, right? But only one who has attained proximity to that status can be considered to be with such people. And our goal in life is to be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Yeah? Salat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. That's the goal, right? Like with that, we can never lose focus of what the goal is. This is why we recite in ziyarat, Allahumma ja'alna ma'ahum fi dunya wal akhirah. Allah, make us be amongst them. We want to be with them. Yeah, so it's not something that's out of the realm of possibility. You know, sometimes people say they are there, we can't touch them. Yes, they are there. We can't reach that status 100%. But man, we can strive to be in the same ballpark as them. Yeah, we can strive to be in the same hall as them. We can strive to be in the same Jannah as them, right? But they are a status of their own. There's no denying this whatsoever. But we wouldn't be taught to ask for this dua, where we say, Allahumma ja'alna ma'ahum fi dunya wal akhirah. Place us amongst them in dunya and akhirah, unless it was possible to be in that same Jannah as them. Right? And so the goal is to be with them, but we can't be with them unless we begin to embody them. We can't be with them until I myself have some siddiq, some truthfulness in me, because they are siddiq and siddiqa. How then can I be with them if I'm not a sadiq or a sadiqa? And so the question is that how do we be this? And this is, Allah encourages us to strive for this. The verse we recited in the khutbah from Surah Tawbah, verse 119, Allah Azza wa Jal says, Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ittaqullah, be conscious of Allah, be mindful of Allah, wa kunu ma'as-sadiqeen, and be amongst the truthful. Right? Allah is prompting us to strive in our lives to be amongst those who are truthful in everything we do. And so the question again comes is, how do we become truthful? How do we reach this status? These verbs, or these words that we said, that she has reached the status of being a siddiqa, he had reached the status of being a siddiq, it comes from the root word of sidq. Yeah? Sad, dal, qaf. A person who is truthful is a sadiq, we said. A lady who is truthful is known as a sadiqa. But then there is another level higher than that, where you now have a shadda on that dal. Yeah, where now you're not a sadiq, but you are a siddiq. You're not a sadiqa, but you are a siddiqa. And so consider these like two levels, right? The first level is that a person strives in their lives to become a sadiq or a sadiqa. The second level is a person then strives and attains such a status where they graduate to now become a siddiq or a siddiqa. The aim should be at the higher level, but I can't get to that higher level without going through the levels that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has placed amongst us. So how do we then first and foremost start off to where at least I can be called a sadiq or I can be called a sadiqa, right? This is, as we said, it means to be truthful. This truthfulness is not just a truthfulness in speech. Yeah, it starts off with that, right? Because that's the most common attribution of truthfulness there is. Is this person, can I believe them or not, right? And this is why, you know, sometimes like we're told not to joke around too much, yeah? Joke, but not joke around too much, yeah? Make people laugh, but not to that extent where now anytime you say something, you're like, bro, I don't know if it was true or not, yeah? It's funny, but I don't know if it was true or not. You don't want that reputation where now people genuinely can't tell whether you are being truthful or not, because that's how important truthfulness is to this picture, right? And so it starts off with speech, but then it continues where truthfulness now manifests itself in my belief. It manifests itself in my actions. It manifests itself in my intentions. It manifests itself in my behavior. The mother of Emma. Ya Fatima, the mother of Aima. Ya Fatima, you are
shall say, on that fearful day, to Allah we'll pray, raise us with a Zahra, we shall say.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
That was the week that was. Beyond the headlines, we dissect the stories that shaped the past 7 days, from the heart of region to the global stage. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to our political chat show, That Was the Week That Was. We look at global politics and issues of the day, and I'm your host, Leila Garcia. With me here in the studio is veteran journalist and political commentator, Miranda Akhshand. Please stay tuned. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Today's discussion is about Donald Trump's eldest son saying his father may walk away from the Ukrainian war, and end America's support for Ukraine, as well as the latest efforts to end the war between Russia and Ukraine. Donald Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., has said his father may walk away from the Ukrainian war. He was speaking at a Middle East conference in Doha, Qatar on Sunday, 7 December. In a lengthy tirade against the purpose of continued fighting in Ukraine, Donald Trump Jr. also said Ukraine's corrupt rich had fled their country, leaving what they believed to be the peasant class to fight the war. Trump Jr. has no formal role inside his father's administration, but is a key figure in the Make America Great Again movement. His intervention reflects the antipathy among some inside the Trump team towards the Ukrainian government, and comes as Trump's negotiating team is putting pressure on Kiev to give up territory. Trump Jr. said the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was prolonging the war because he knew he would never win an election if it ended. He also railed at the EU's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, saying European sanctions were not working since they had simply increased the price of oil, from which Russia could pay for its war. He described the European plan as we are going to wait for Russia to go bankrupt. That is not a plan. Asked if it was possible his father, who ran for election claiming he could bring peace to Ukraine, would simply walk away. Trump Jr. said maybe he would, adding that his father is one of the most unpredictable people in politics. He vowed that the U.S. was no longer going to be the idiot with the checkbook. Okay, let's bring in veteran journalist and political commentator Miranda Akhshand.
Thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, Donald Trump Jr. said Ukraine's corrupt rich had fled their country, leaving what they believed to be the peasant class to fight the war. Tell us more about that.
Yes, he was speaking in this conference in Doha, Qatar, And he said, without providing any evidence, he said he had observed last summer in a single day in Monaco that 50% of supercars, such as Bugattis and Ferraris, had Ukrainian number plates. And he asked, do you think that was earned in Ukraine? And he said, we hear all the rumors about what is going on, and we see every license plate in Monaco is Ukrainian. Right. The rich fled their country, and they left what they believed to be the peasant class to fight the war. Mm-hmm. There was no incentive to stop, because as long as the money train was coming and they were stealing, no one was auditing anything, so there was no reason to come to peace.
I see.
So that was his reasoning for suggesting that the rich had fled Ukraine and the poor were now fighting the war. Now, Trump's elder son also argued that Ukraine was far more corrupt than Russia. In actual fact, there have been a number of corruption scandals recently that have weakened and damaged the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky in particular. His powerful chief of staff was forced to resign because of a corruption scandal.
Trump Jr. has no formal role inside his father's administration, but he's close to his father. How seriously should we take his comments?
Yes, I think we should take his words seriously because he is close to his father. Donald Trump Jr., as you said, has no formal role in his father's administration, but he is one of the main figures in the Make America Great Again movement, the MAGA movement.
Right.
And basically, what Trump said reflects the fact that there are some within the Trump team are against the Ukrainian government in Ukraine. And Trump's negotiating team is putting pressure on Kiev to give up territory and to accept the Trump peace plan.
Right.
Trump Jr. said the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, was prolonging the war because he knew he would never win an election if the war ended.
Right.
And I think we should take Donald Trump Jr.'s words seriously because he is close to his father.
Yeah.
And there are other indications that Trump's patience with Volodymyr Zelensky and other members of the Ukrainian government is running thin. Donald Trump had threatened in the past that if he felt the Ukrainians were dragging their feet or were disinterested in peace, he would simply walk away and cut off Ukraine's support and let the Ukrainians fight it out with the Russians. So he said that on other occasions in the past. So I think we should take the words of Donald Trump Jr. seriously. Right.
Trump has said Volodymyr Zelensky isn't ready to sign off on a U.S.-authored peace proposal aimed at ending the war between Russia and Ukraine. What is the latest on that?
Yes, the latest is that Donald Trump has said Zelensky isn't ready to sign off on his peace proposal, and there have been 3 days of negotiations between a Ukrainian delegation and the Trump administration in Florida, in Mar-a-Lago, Florida. Trump said, I'm a little bit disappointed that President Zelensky hasn't yet read the proposal. That was as of a few hours ago. His people loved it, he said, but he hasn't read it. Now, days of negotiations between U.S. and Ukrainian officials ended in Florida on Saturday. And Zelensky, of course, met with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, and Germany's chancellor, Friedrich Merz, on Monday, 8th of December, and Starmer has repeatedly stressed that Ukraine must determine its own future and said a European peacekeeping force would play a vital role in guaranteeing Ukraine's security. But the fact that Donald Trump, of course, tried to bring peace to Gaza, and the U.S. is now working to push through a peace plan between Ukraine and Russia, U.S. officials claim that they're in the final stages of reaching an agreement between Ukraine and Russia, but there is little sign that either the Ukrainians or the Russians are willing to sign up to Donald Trump's peace plan.
Right.
Trump has said, Russia is, I believe, fine with the peace deal, but I'm not sure that Zelensky is fine with it.
Yeah.
His people love it, but Zelensky isn't ready. Well, as far as I can say, Trump has had a hot and cold relationship with Zelensky, on-again, off-again relationship with Volodymyr Zelensky, and has repeatedly urged the Ukrainians to cede land to Russia in order to bring the conflict to an end.
Right.
And Trump has said this conflict has, this war has already cost far too many lives. Now, Zelensky said last Saturday that he had a substantive phone call with his officials in Florida who were negotiating with the Trump administration. He said he had been given an update over the phone by both U.S. and Ukrainian officials in, who were involved in the peace talks in Florida. So that's the latest on that.
I see. In its new national security strategy published overnight on Saturday, the White House said it was committed to Ukraine's survival as a viable state. But the strategy also prioritized improving relations with Moscow. Tell us more about that.
Yes, the U.S. national security strategy has alarmed European leaders, but it has been welcomed by Russia. For example, Dmitry Peskov, Kremlin spokesman, said the new U.S. national security strategy spells out the Trump administration's core foreign policy interests, and it was largely in line with Moscow's vision, he said.
Right.
The document released by the White House said that U.S. wanted to improve its relations with Russia after years of Moscow being treated as effectively a pariah state, and U.S. also wants to end the war between Russia and Ukraine, and this was a core U.S. interest, it said, to end the war, to reestablish strategic stability with Russia.
Right.
This new U.S. national security strategy, this new document also said that NATO must not be a perpetually expanding alliance. And this is another point that the Russians have been complaining about, that NATO keeps continually expanding. So it also made a point about migration and free speech in Europe, suggesting that the Europeans face the prospect of civilizational erasure because of migration to Europe. Now, the Europeans have been rather annoyed by that suggestion. They're saying that this is direct interference in European affairs by the Trump administration, so the Europeans haven't taken kindly to that. And we can say that despite efforts by Donald Trump and his team to push through a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine, so far it seems that we're still some way off from actually signing a peace deal.
Right. Listening to the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran, English Radio. This program entitled, That Was the Week That Was. Russia has welcomed the Trump administration's new national security strategy. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said the updated strategic document, which spells out the administration's core foreign policy interests, was largely in line with Moscow's vision. Can you expand that for us?
Yes, Peskov actually praised Donald Trump's latest national security strategy, calling it encouraging. It's an encouraging change of policy in Washington that largely aligns with Moscow's thinking. So this document was published or released on Saturday, and it criticizes the European Union, saying Europe is at risk of civilizational erasure. And it says that the United States is keen to establish better relations with Russia.
Right.
So as Peskov said, the Trump administration was in favor of dialogue and building good relations with Moscow. But Peskov also warned that the U.S. deep state could try to sabotage Donald Trump's vision, which was spelled out in this new national security strategy.
Yeah. What about Europe? What is the European position on Donald Trump's peace plan for Russia and Ukraine?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Europeans are generally skeptical and rather wary of Donald Trump's peace plan for Ukraine. European leaders want to show their solidarity with Ukraine as the White House pressures Kiev to accept a peace deal with Russia. For example, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer insisted that he won't be putting pressure on Volodymyr Zelensky to accept a peace settlement, unlike the Americans. And the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz expressed skepticism about Donald Trump's peace proposal.
I see.
And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has previously called on his European allies for support at times when the White House has tried to push Ukraine towards agreeing to give up territory.
Mm-hmm.
So a key issue for Kiev is what security guarantees it would receive if it does agree to renounce control over some territory, particularly in the east of the country.
Mm-hmm.
It is not clear that either the United States or Europe are willing to offer the kind of security guarantees that would genuinely deter Russia from attacking Ukraine. And we can also say that U.S. officials have claimed to be close to a sustainable peace deal between Russia and Ukraine on a number of occasions in the past, and particularly since Donald Trump began his second term in office. But all these occasions, it turned out that this was just wishful thinking on the part of Trump administration officials. The Europeans generally view peace in Ukraine as being a distant prospect. That's how they really view it, as a distant prospect. And they think quite a lot of work needs to be done before we actually get to peace in Ukraine. Now, Donald Trump's outgoing Ukraine envoy, Keith Kellogg, said at a Middle East Defense Forum on Saturday that the Trump administration's efforts to end the war in Ukraine were in their last 10 meters, he said. And according to Keith Kellogg, Donald Trump's Ukraine envoy, there were two outstanding issues in the peace talks. One was about territory, the territory which the Russians had captured in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And the other was the fate of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. So those two issues were still unresolved.
Right. To sum up very briefly then, the comments by Donald Trump's eldest son should be taken seriously since he is close to his father. And Trump himself had indicated in the past that his patience was running thin with the Ukrainians because they were dragging their feet or wasting time and they didn't seem to be interested in peace. Thank you, Mr. Rakshander, for your insightful analysis.
Thanks for inviting me.
For more on these and other critical issues, be sure to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Join us again next time for another edition of That Was the Week That Was. Take care and goodbye.
Before over a million times, who would ever thought that it would be our time? I just know it, 'cause you're the one. It ain't a selfish love when I'm with you. Remind me of the moment so I know it's true. I'll just say it, you are the one. Won't you be my BFF forever?
don't you know it? You are the one. You are the one. Oh, won't you be the one?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance.
The U.S. sometimes, but not always, says that it's willing to cooperate with Iran. Cooperation with Iran isn't compatible with cooperating and helping the accursed Zionist regime. The accursed Zionist regime with this situation that it has created and the entire world has witnessed, understood, and condemned is being... The accursed Zionist regime with this situation that it has created and the entire world has witnessed, understood, and condemned is being assisted by the U.S. The U.S. is backing it. They're supporting it. Given this situation, cooperation with Iran is meaningless and unacceptable. Yes, if they were to completely stop supporting the Zionist regime, remove their military bases from this area, and stop interfering in the region, these matters could potentially be reviewed. This isn't something foreseeable for now, nor for the near future. What I wish to tell you, dear young people, is the following. First, you must increase your knowledge, familiarity, and awareness of the country's fundamental political issues pertaining to the past, present, and the future. You must truly analyze these circles of knowledge that I mentioned, and analyze our country's past and the events that have taken place. Where have we suffered losses? Where have we achieved gains? Where have we shown weakness? Where have we exhibited strength? And what have the consequences of each of these experiences been?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In addition, scientific advancements must continue in the country. A few years ago, our momentum in making scientific advancements was very good, but it has slowed down somewhat. I want to tell the officials of our universities, our researchers, and our students that they mustn't allow scientific progress to decline. The rapid speed of this progress is essential for us. The country must move forward in science. The country must also advance militarily, and by God's grace, our military personnel are working diligently day and night. God willing, we will make even further advancements. By God's grace, the country will be able to show that it's a strong nation, and no power, regardless of its capabilities, will be able to force the Iranian nation to surrender or bring it to its knees. Almighty God will help us. Strengthen your connections with God through prayer, the Quran, and by becoming acquainted with the truths of religion. Get help from divine assistance and create a better future for yourselves and for the nation, God willing. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to all our listeners from around the world. You are tuning to Iran Radio. I'm here in the studio of Iran Radio in Tehran announcing our program schedule for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. We start tonight's lineup with today's special daily mixed format program that deals with various Islamic and Iranian occasions. Next up is Israel Watch. The program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about current events and issues in the West Asia region. They will be followed by Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. And to round up this hour's programs, we have Let's Recite the Holy Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Holy Quran at level 2. Stay with us for the next hour.